We are proud members of the Spy Podcast Network. Find out more at www.spypodcasts.com.
This is the Le Carre Cast. A member of the British Foreign Office haunts the foggy streets of Bonn, stumbling over ex-Nazis at every turn. That's not only the setup for the novel A Small Town in Germany, it was also the life of John le Carré, the pen name of David Cornwell, who in the early 1960s was working as an agent of MI6 in West Germany. His job? Keep an eye out for a potential resurgence of Nazism in the fledgling West German government. That work greatly influenced his fifth novel, released in 1968, A Small Town in Germany. It was also what I would call his first overtly of-the-moment political novel. While past novels had touched on refugees, or communism, or the Berlin Wall, Small Town lays out a specific political worldview and concerns over where Germany and the UK might be going. Bonn, which had become the capital of West Germany after Germany was split in two in 1949, had a number of ex-Nazis in positions of power, with the Chancellor of West Germany from 1966 to 69 having been a former member of the Nazi Party. The story, about the search for a member of the British Embassy in Bonn who's disappeared with important files, just as the UK is attempting to join the common market, and Bonn is hit with turbulent riots, veers into alternate history, but at the time, Cornwell's real life was just as turbulent as his fictional story. This time in his life also leads to what is probably his nastiest novel. Cornwell refers to the novel's protagonist, Alan Turner, as being a surrogate, and given what Cornwell was going through at the time, it's obvious he wasn't thinking too highly of himself. Turner is an ugly, brutish character that Cornwell only makes minor attempts to redeem. Le Carré's fears for West Germany in the late 1960s didn't come to fruition, but his story about far-right populist leaders rallying a group of like-minded followers to seize power, about followers who feel aggrieved over their so-called lower place in life, about politicians who are fine sweeping dirty secrets under the rug if they think it will suit their own needs, about how the world can occasionally feel like a coin flip from turning the clock back to the 1930s. Well, that story seems more relevant now than it ever did before, because we've seen those fears that for decades seem preposterous, become closer to reality, not just in Germany, but around the world. A Small Town in Germany shows that these types of worries have been with us before. The book, like all good literature, shines a mirror on the worst of ourselves. It doesn't let us look away from the potential dark future that beckons. Instead, it gives us the opportunity, by taking a hard look at ourselves, and wake up to take actions in the here and now, and avoid it. Hello and welcome to Le Carre Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. Each episode we take a deeper dive into all things Le Carre. Today I am pleased to welcome James Wolfe to the program. James has written two novels. His first, Beside the Syrian Sea, was the Times Book of the Month and an Evening Standard Book of the Year. His latest is How to Portray Your Country. Both focus on rejects from the world of espionage. James's background involves working for the British government for over 10 years, and he spent his youth growing up in the Middle East. James, thanks for coming on to talk Le Carre today.
Pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
So we're going to be doing a deep dive into all things A Small Town in Germany, So folks listening, prepare for spoilers, because we're definitely going to be diving into all of that. But first, James, I was hoping you could tell me a bit about your own relationship, if any, with reading Le Carre.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it started in my late teens and early 20s. I think that a lot of readers probably come to Le Carre at around the same time as they come to a reader like Graham Greene. You know, someone who's curious about the world, who's literary, but in an accessible way. And of course, it seemed hopelessly exciting for someone who had been in that world to be writing these novels, which were sort of literary and focused on character and were often very well written, but had this espionage framework, this sort of narrative engine running through the middle of them that made them so compulsively readable. So I think probably in my late teens and early 20s, I read most of his books, and then I retained an interest in him as he continued writing. We might talk about this later, but I think for myself, I definitely lost some interest in him when he stopped writing about the Cold War, and he started sort of looking more widely for his subjects, and I think he lost some of what made him distinctive in that process. But I was sort of retained a fondness for him and kept reading his books and read Silver View, his last. And it was a real pleasure, actually, to have this opportunity to go back and read one of his early books that I probably haven't read for 20 or 25 years.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a very different book of his, I would say. Different even from what we think of as the classics, you know, from the Cold War, I would say. Would you agree with that?
I would. I mean, one of the things that makes him such an interesting writer is it feels that there are different parts of his career in which he was writing such distinctively different books. You know, the first two books that he referred to as finger exercises, I think, at one point, it seemed quite kind of slight and quite genre heavy and, you know, have patches of lovely writing in them, but are quite conventional books in some ways. Then, of course, The Spy Came In From the Cold exploded onto the scene. And then these books, I mean, I see this as part of a set maybe with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and The Looking Glass War. These books are incredibly dense, maybe a little bit too dense, I think. Extremely well written. And you really get a sense of Le Carre's literary talent in these books. But then I think if you jump ahead to the later Le Carre, I mean, I think he's almost unrecognizable. I think if I didn't know they were by the same person, and if they weren't preoccupied with so many of the same things, in terms of the language and the way he writes, it's very hard for you to match up this book, for example, with Silver View. I know he was quite old when he wrote Silver View, and it may not have been a finished manuscript. But the kind of literary density of these books is really striking. There's someone has worked really hard at the sentences, at the paragraphs, at the dialogue. And I think one of my problems with later Le Carre is that I read entire books and didn't feel there was a distinctive sentence in them anywhere. It felt like he'd just kind of dashed them off. But I mean, it's one of the things that makes him interesting to me, this sense that he had all these different periods in his career, and he was so many different writers during his career.
Yeah, I think some of the criticisms that he got for this kind of right after Spy Who Came In From the Cold novels were that maybe they were a little too literary. They were maybe overwritten, which I think you could say, I think definitely with Looking Glass War and this one to a certain extent, I think you could maybe make that case, because there are some, he does seem to kind of go overboard with some of his flourishes to a certain extent, I would say. I don't know if you disagree with that.
No, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I think also it's, you know, it's a little bit of COD philosophy, but it's also quite fun to look at these books and think about what was going through Le Carre's mind in terms of how he saw himself as a writer. I think, as you discussed with previous guests before on the podcast, the enormous success of The Spy Coming From the Cold was probably quite destabilizing. And he probably resented in some ways that he was suddenly pigeonholed as a thriller writer when he had this huge literary talent. And I think The Looking Glass War and this book that we're discussing today feel in a way to me as though he is trying to, you know, he's testing the elastic. He's seeing how far he can grow away from that book that defined him. How far is he going to be allowed to go? You know, can he write about an espionage world in The Looking Glass War that is defined by incompetence and bureaucracy and failure? In this book, can he write a book that's not really about espionage? I mean, we can talk about a little bit later on about Alan Turner and his character and who he represents in this, but it's quite easy to read this not really as a spy novel. So I really see the two books as Le Carre experimenting with who he is and trying to pull away from this identity that defined him. And of course, you see that coming to its fruition in the Naive and Sentimental Lover, a book which is not a genre novel, not a thriller, not a spy novel, but of course was a resounding failure. And he, you know, the Elastic had, you know, he bounced back from that, and he landed in Tinker Tailor and never looked back. But I think it's interesting to see that arc. It's interesting to see these early novels, to see what he was probably trying to do, and then when he ended up later on.
As I was kind of looking into this particular novel a little bit more, I don't know if you've ever seen this interview with, it's Malcolm Muggeridge, where he's interviewed.
This is right after
The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. But Muggeridge, who was also a spy in his olden days, you know, previously, wrote a review of A Small Town in Germany. And in it, it's basically he doesn't rip it apart, but he's not happy with the novel. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like the novel. And he talks about how disappointed he is that Le Carre continues to go in the espionage vein. You mentioned this isn't really an espionage novel, and it's not, but it's close enough to that. And he thinks that Le Carre should be doing more things like A Naive and Sentimental Lover, which he later does. And it makes me wonder whether Le Carre read that and decided he needed to push himself even further.
The other very interesting thing about that interview is that I think Muggeridge asks him the question, are you a spy writer? Are you going to continue to write spy novels? And Le Carre says, you know, I don't think I will. I think I'm going to move into other pastures. It was clearly his intention. And yet, if you look at the overall arc of his career, it's something he failed at. I know he was enormously successful at what he did, but he obviously had that desire to move away and write books that weren't about this one topic, but he never really succeeded at that.
It's funny that he had this conversation then, and then Muggeridge comes back, reviews this book. He says here, "It's really too bad that a talented writer like Le Carre should get stuck like this. Suppose, for instance, it had happened to Dickens, and he had been induced to go on writing the adventures of the Pickwick Club for the rest of his life. For a young writer, or indeed a young practitioner of any art, to become suddenly successful can be utterly disastrous as far as the development of his talent is concerned. I can think of 10 or 12 very promising contemporary writers who have come to grief in this way. In our sort of society, success is something that the vultures gather round as they do round the famous towers in Bombay where Parsi corpses are laid to rot." Well, okay, I don't need to keep going. He's going on a little long there. But you get the idea that there's this, you know, talent wasted by staying there. And, it, you know, part of that, I'm sure, is just the literary kind of snobbishness. But it is interesting to think about how when Le Carre did try and turn away from that, it was his most disastrous novel.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's true. And I haven't read Adam Sisman's biography. I don't really know very much about Le Carre's character, what kind of a man he was. But there was obviously something in the failure of maybe these two books and The Naive and Sentimental Lover that he just couldn't take. He had tasted success, potentially. He tasted success and he didn't like the failure of these books and wanted to return to something there. I really don't know. But it's just a very fascinating arc to observe from the outside. It's very sort of easy, maybe a little bit inaccurate, but it's easy to sort of infer certain thoughts he was having as he was writing these books.
So what was, you know, just generally, before we really get in the weeds, what were your general thoughts of this book? Did you enjoy reading it? Were you impressed, less than impressed?
You know, we originally scheduled this podcast a little while ago, and I read the book before that. And then I came back this last week to have a look at it again, just to refresh my memory. And I was struck really by, you know, coming back to it. I didn't have a sense of enthusiasm. And I think I realized that I find it quite an inhospitable book. It's very clever in lots of ways. I think the plot is brilliant. I think it's structured very, very skillfully. But I think it's quite a dense and overwritten book. And it's one that I think I wouldn't return to anytime soon, as much as I do admire it in lots of ways.
Yeah, you know, it's been a while since I had read it. And when I came back to it, I think it is a book that doesn't necessarily benefit from a reread. Once you know where it's going, I think it feels a little more, some of the things that he's doing in there with his lead character Turner, I think, become more irritating than not. Knowing where it's going, it is a very interesting book. I mean, it's basically a book of interrogations, right?
Mm.
Turner is everybody gets their turn at the table to tell their story, and we're piece by piece finding out a little bit more about this character that everybody's hunting for. And if you like the characters that you're getting to hear, I think that makes that chapter work a little better than maybe the next one, where you're less as enthused about hearing from this person's voice.
Yeah, I mean, you say that everyone gets the chance to tell their story, and boy, do they tell their story. I mean, you know, some people who love to talk in this book, and one of the things I really puzzled over was, you know, Alan Turner, you described, who's the protagonist. I think it would be a stretch to call him a hero, but he's the protagonist driving the investigation into this missing junior diplomat. Is a very difficult and awkward character who annoys everyone intensely. And yet people talk to him for pages and pages and pages and deliver monologues and speeches and give their thoughts about the political situation. And they talk about their personal life and they really unburden themselves to this man, even while he is verbally abusing them and even sometimes physically abusing them. And I think that sort of speaks to one of the big problems I have with the book, which is, that I don't really think that Le Carre himself likes any of the characters in the book.
Mm.
Now, I don't really go in for the whole thing about likable characters that you sort of see constantly in Amazon reviews of books. You know, I'm not talking about characters who one aspires to be or wants to be or sees oneself in. But I think it's very important that the writer likes the characters that he's writing about. And even if they're doing terrible things, the writer thinks that there's something interesting in their psychology or interesting about their evolution or possibilities that they've turned their back on or whatever it is. But I really read this book and thought, boy, Le Carre hates every single one of these people. And he even hates Turner, who's the protagonist. The only character who he likes is Leo Harting, who is the junior diplomat who disappears. But Harting only appears in the prologue and in the epilogue. And then in between those two, you have a parade of these terrible people. And it's all quite sort of entertaining and intense, but it's just quite kind of dark, I think, and unrelenting.
Yeah. Well, and Le Carre says, I think in one of his introductions, that Turner was basically him and he kind of hated himself at that time. So that is not surprising that Turner comes off the worst of all of these characters that we kind of run into there. Let's set up the plot a little bit. So it's actually pretty simple once you kind of look past all the smoke Le Carre has put out in the air. You got Leo Harting, a German who works at the British Embassy in Bonn, Germany, and he's disappeared with some important files for reasons unknown. Everybody assumes he's, you know, run to the Russians and was spying on them the whole time. Alan Turner is sent to find him and or assess the damage. But the truth is that we find out later through after endless interrogations of all these various people that Harting has actually figured out that Klaus Karfeld, a rising star in German politics, is actually a former Nazi he tangled with before, and Leo is trying to kill him before he comes to power. No surprise, it ends badly for Leo, as happens in most Le Carre novels. So that's kind of the setup. And it's actually a little bit, your novel, Beside the Syrian Sea, it's almost a mirror image of that book in the setup, because you have somebody who takes a bunch of files for reasons unknown with various spies trying to figure out what's going on. You know, would you agree with that kind of assessment, at least broad strokes, kind of the setup there? And how does that influence your view of this novel?
Yeah, I hadn't really noticed the similarity, but I suppose you're right. I mean, what I am trying to do in the two books I've written and the third one that's coming out next year is sort of bring these traditional ideas of loyalty and betrayal up to date. So trying really to take them out of the Cold War context and imagine what modern reasons for betrayal would look like. So all of the protagonists of my three books are people who have been on the inside and have misbehaved and done something bad and have found themselves on the outside, but their motivation is not political loyalty to another country or even, you know, that they've been paid a lot of money by the Russians to steal things. They all have very personal motives. Then the protagonist in the first book that you mentioned is driven by a desire to rescue his father, who's kidnapped in Syria. The protagonist doesn't have the wherewithal to raise the funds that have been demanded, and so instead steals intelligence and tries to use the intelligence as a ransom to get his father released. I suppose it is, as you pointed out, a fairly traditional beginning or inciting incident, as they'd say in the film world. But I try in that book to take it into a different direction.
Well, and it is interesting because I think normally we do see it from the perspective of the person kind of on the run, I would say. This is like a rather rarity where you see that person is at a remove for the entire book and you never really get that confrontation that you really want, right? I mean, and I would say that probably plays to a little bit of its detriment. would you agree with that? That Leo is such a cipher?
Yeah, I would. I agree completely. I mean, Le Carre has a real talent for names. And I think if you look at the name Leo Harting, it tells you a lot about the character. Leo the lion, Leo's a character who in some ways is quite gentle, but has a real ferocity about him, has a real intensity of purpose, and is someone you don't cross because he will remember it and he will exact his revenge. But also Harting, he's the heart of the book. He is the only character, as I said, who I feel Le Carre likes or has any time for. But we don't see him except at these two scenes at the beginning and at the end. And so what you have in the middle is you have all of these characters reflecting on their encounters with Leo Harting and what they thought of him and this story and that story. And I think this is another aspect of the book that I found flawed, is that Leo Harting starts to take on this kind of almost mystical quality. People talk about him in this special way, as though Leo was this, Leo was that. You know, no one knew who he was. He was a will-o'-the-wisp. He was here. He was there. He was charming. All these women fall for him. And it feels like there's a lot of pressure placed upon that one character, that he has to be all of these things to all of these people in order to carry the story. And it just didn't quite ring true for me. I didn't quite buy the character that was being presented, and I didn't quite buy everyone's response to him.
Yeah, because you have some people who, you know, I mean, he does sound like, I don't know, I've encountered these people in my life. The ones, they have a gravity where, like, people are just drawn to them, right? You know, they're always, they know everybody. They know how to do something. They know how to get you what you want. You know, you give them something, they'll give you something. You know, that's the kind of character that you get the sense of Leo, but from the majority of the people. But then there's others that, like, have very different views. And I think some of that comes through the class, you know, because Leo is very low in power compared to most of the people that we're talking with here, right? But you get this very stratified sense of the embassy in Bonn, which Le Carre worked at. You know, I mean, he worked at the embassy there. And so you get the sense that he's definitely pulling from life in this one, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think on the character of Leo, he is those things that you described, but as well as being charming and able to draw things out of people, he's also described as kind of insignificant and you know, easy to dismiss. And I felt that there were too many versions of Leo floating around, and I couldn't quite get a sense of which one of them was true. It's possible that he just had a different face for everyone, but it felt to me as though it ended up being a little bit confusing. But you're quite right about the embassy in Bonn and about the way that Le Carre describes it, obviously based on his own personal experience of working there. It's almost a little microcosm of England in the middle of this city and this country and this continent undergoing huge change. So you've got all these social pressures on the outside. There's the UK is looking to join the common market. It is desperate for a sort of alliance with Germany to allow it to join the common market. The French don't want the English to join. But then there's all these tensions inside Germany that you mentioned, with the rise of a nationalist populist leader, Karfeld, and what's that going to mean? So there's this little English world that's stuck in the middle of this city, undergoing all these pressures, very claustrophobic. The Germans have put in place all these security measures around the British embassy because they're afraid of demonstrations and people being hurt. So you've got, you know, German intelligence personnel following around the British and, you know, in one case even beating Alan Turner up. And it also, the setup allows Le Carre to indulge in, you know, one of his favorite themes, which is British class. You know, you've got these, as I said, these like parade of pretty horrible characters, some of them who are at the top of the social class and who sort of have real confidence in themselves and their position and their abilities and a sense of entitlement about them. And then, you know, people at the bottom end of the ladder. I mentioned earlier that, you know, Le Carré's talent for names in naming Leo Harting as he did. But there are wonderful names in this. Peter DeLisle, I thought, was a wonderful name for a kind of stuffy diplomat. There's a small Welshman called Gaunt, which is wonderful. And best of all, I thought, the cipher clerk called Cork. I mean, I thought that's just a wonderful name for the person who's responsible for, you know, keeping all the secrets bottled in. What better name for a character like that than Cork?
Yeah, no, I mean, this, he really does get to indulge in his creation of characters. You'd see that later, I think, better in like Tinker Tailor, right? Where he really, because, I mean, in this book, we get like deep dives into each of these characters, right? Too much, I think we've kind of already said. Whereas in Tinker Tailor, I think you get these more, they're a little sketchier, but that's better, I think, especially because he does do a good job of, within the first couple paragraphs, we already know the people that we're hearing from, right? We don't need more, I think, because he is so good at giving you that right away, zeroing in on a specific voice for the various people. We talk about how there's so many of these, you know, long monologues, these long dialogues, but you get the sense they're all very different types of speeches and dialogues. These are very different people, and that comes through, I thought, very well.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's funny how English a novel this is, despite the title and despite the setting. I mean, it's a really profoundly English novel. You know, he's got a great eye for character. He's got a great eye for what makes people distinctive. He's got a great way of capturing them in a few words. It's interesting that you said that Le Carré sees himself in the character Alan Turner, because Alan Turner is a sort of, you know, a fair-haired, large northern man who wears the wrong kind of jacket and is super blunt and rubs everyone up the wrong way, which is very different to my impression of what Le Carré was like as a person. But it may have been, I suppose, how Le Carré saw himself on the inside. And he did, you know, a lot has been said about his father, a lot has been said about his personal circumstances. I mean, he said, I think, once that he's, you know, his family were actually very working class. He had, you know, uncles and aunts and cousins who did very working class jobs. And then his father came along and indulged in this huge pretense of being an upper class gent. And so Le Carré obviously had this dual sense of who he was. You know, he was inhabiting this polished character in the world that he did. But maybe on the inside, he felt more like an Alan Turner, I suppose, someone who just didn't fit in. And there's wonderful bits of class stuff in this. You know, there's near the beginning when we see Alan Turner for the first time and he goes into his office, he meets his boss who gives him this mission that he's got to go to Bonn and investigate the disappearance of Leo Harting. And as Alan Turner walks away, his boss sort of watches him go and ruminates and says, this is what happens when we let the non-officer class into the club. You know, they speak the wrong way, they wear the wrong kind of jacket, they annoy people. And that kind of stuff runs all the way through his book and all the way through all of his books, I think.
The way this book starts is kind of odd to me. It really takes a while to get going in my mind. Tell me if you feel different, but like we start out with this kind of really, frankly, kind of hard to follow opening where the one time we get to see Leo, it's like you got to go finish the book and then go back and reread that again to understand what the heck was going on there, because it makes no sense. And then you get this kind of odd couple scene where I think it's Meadows and Cork are driving to the embassy and they're doing this, I don't know if you know the Muppets, but it's kind of like a Statler and Waldorf kind of thing where they're, you know, back and forth with each other, you know, and then, you know, they're talking about how Leo's missing and they know it's serious when he doesn't show up to play the organ for the embassy chapel service, you know. It's just some really weird stuff, but all of that, it takes a long time, or many, many pages before we finally get to Turner and get the sense that, okay, this is the person that we're actually kind of be focusing on and have to follow, right? I mean, I did you feel the same way?
I felt exactly the same way. I mean, the book explodes into life when Alan Turner arrives. And yeah. In my copy, that's page 40. And the first 40 pages, I mean, wonderfully written. I mean, Le Carre's a talented writer. But as you say, the prologue is mystifying. What is this character? But also, what is he doing? He's following someone who gets into a car, and then a policeman comes up and asks him what he's doing. It's very hard to know what any of it is about. And actually, the first time I reread it, I got to the end, and it was only something that sort of caught in my memory. I sort of remembered back to the prologue and went back and had a look at it. And then, as you say, you've got this long car drive. When you know between and these two characters talking about the church service and Leo Harting being missing, when you know the plot, you realize that Le Carre is seeding a lot of key ideas in that early chapter. You know, there's stuff about certain items going missing in the embassy. There's endless talk of a trolley. There's a two-bar electric heater. There's some cups, whatever it is. But there's a long discussion about where these things are. And of course, it turns out to be significant because Leo has created this little hideaway in the embassy, which he's equipped with all these things that he's stolen from various other places. And that's where he does his studies. That's where he does his kind of deep dive into the files to try and work out what Carl Feld really did. But it's a tough 40 pages. This comes back to my use of the word inhospitable to describe it. I mean, he doesn't go out of his way to make you feel amused or entertained or comfortable. There's lots of scratching your head and thinking how, I mean, I'm sure this is going to be explained later, but you know, it doesn't make much sense to me at the moment. But as I said, I really think the book comes to life. Alan Turner walks in and immediately he's annoying people. This is a man who can't walk into a room without annoying someone. And he's fabulously blunt and really speaks his mind to everyone. And I think he's a wonderful character. And I think in a different book, I would have enjoyed him more. But as I've already said, I just get the sense that Le Carre doesn't like any of these characters, particularly including Turner.
Yeah, I think Turner, he does kind of light up the room with his just irritation with everybody. And I like the way Le Carre immediately shows that he is smart. He comes in, you know, his boss wants to see him, but he's going to go through the telegrams and all the stuff that came in. And he immediately starts putting pieces together, right? And he leaves his colleague with, because one of the things that we find out is there's been this attack on this library there. It's called the British Library, and they've attacked the librarian there. She's been injured. She's in the hospital. And then they started burning a bunch of the books. And Turner's tells them that even though it's called the British Library, it's actually owned by the Germans, and so they were burning their own books, not the British books. And so his colleagues like, "Oh, that's a good one. I'm going to tell the press people that to use that one." So you immediately he comes across as a competent person, and I liked that. But here's a question for you, because this is something that I've pondered since first reading the book. You know, the setup is that Turner is a member of the Foreign Office, and he's sent there to investigate this. And one of the things that doesn't come up at all, which is kind of hard to believe, is that everybody thinks Leo has taken these files and has gone to the Russians or somebody else. He's been spying on them this whole time. But unstated there is the fact that in every embassy, there was an MI6 station. And that gets no mention at all, which I assume is a very conscious decision by Le Carre, because he felt bound by the Official Secrets Act that he couldn't say anything about that. And so is Turner really supposed to be a MI6 spy? Or what are your thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting question, and I'm not really sure I have a clear sense of what the answer is. Obviously, Le Carre makes reference to MI6 in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. He sort of acknowledges that there is a UK intelligence agency that works overseas. But of course, this is before the British government officially acknowledged the existence of MI6, which I think happened in 94. It may, and this is all speculation, but it may well have been that the success of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold took his former employers by surprise. And they didn't really want him to keep on writing books about an organization that the British government hadn't even admitted existed. And so in both of these books, The Looking Glass War and The Small Town in Germany, you know, in the Looking Glass War, there's a military intelligence department that engages with these, you know, in these sort of slightly comic and bumbling espionage missions overseas. And in this book, as you say, ostensibly he's a Foreign Office investigator. it may be that he came under pressure to distance himself or distance his stories from the world that he did previously inhabit. And there's also a bit in there where there's a whole chapter devoted, rather an odd chapter devoted to a dinner party later on in the book. And this very important German character called Siebkron is there, who is a sort of head of internal security. And he asks Turner where he's from, and Turner says he's from the Foreign Office. But it's described in a way as though, you know, they all look very intently at him, and maybe Turner feels a little bit uncomfortable. There's a mood around him saying that suggests it's not quite true, that he's not just a straightforward employee of the Foreign Office. Having said all of that, I'm sure there is a security department of the Foreign Office that looks at diplomats and looks at their behavior. I mean, the files that Leo Harting is alleged to have stolen are not intelligence files. They're just very routine embassy files. I mean, one of them is sensitive because it has records of diplomatic conversations with senior German figures. But it's not as though he has stolen MI6 secrets. So I think there may be something in what you say, but I also read it and I didn't really feel that he was, it felt like it was a plausible story the way he set it up.
Yeah. I mean, I think it works, and it doesn't have to have that element to it to really, for his plot to work. It does seem, I've looked to try and figure out when it was kind of public knowledge that there'd be like a MI6 station inside the embassy, and when that really came out. And I haven't really found a great answer for that. So that, you know, I'm sure he felt like he couldn't say that in this book, that there would be, you know, spies working out of the embassy, because even though everybody knows it and everybody makes a reference, right, to Turner being a spy, there's a reporter that does that same kind of a thing where they're like, oh, yeah, you're really here looking around, checking the, doing an audit. Yeah, wink, 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 nod, nod kind of a thing. And there are there's a couple of subtle references in the book as well, where when Turner shows up, Delisle says something to him about another character that had been referenced in some previous books who had been kind of connected to that spy world.
Steed Asprey.
Yes, yeah, which made me think, is that like his like one little wink to folks who are close readers that, you know, this there's something else kind of going on here. So I don't know.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, you know, my experience having worked in government, my experience of the censor, because my books have to be run past the censor. My experience of them is that they are incredibly conservative and cautious. And it may well be the case that Le Carré really wanted to write this book that was set in Germany. And maybe in his initial draft of it, he thought, well, you know, I'm going to put some spies in there who are based in the embassy and so on. And it may be that they came back with a no, and then he had to create this fictional Foreign Office security department, and maybe he realized that wouldn't really change things, you know, that it was wouldn't really affect the story. I mean, I have encountered almost that exact problem myself, which is that I wanted to make reference to a station, an MI6 station in a foreign country, and I was told I couldn't, even in, you know, 2020, when all this stuff is in the public domain. I mean, I think that they see a difference between what is kind of in the public consciousness and what has been publicly stated by the government as fact. So while we might know all sorts of things happen or strongly suspect all sorts of things happen, there's a very clear sense that that might be the case, but we are not going to officially confirm it. We're going to leave it as speculation. So even if you wanted to sort of make reference, like, I don't know, I'm going to pick a country at random, but somewhere that's, you know, seen lots of conflict in recent years, like Afghanistan or Iraq, it wouldn't be a straightforward thing to say that there is a MI6 headquarters or station in this country. They might well come back and say, well, actually, we don't want anyone to say that, even though everyone knows it's true. And in 1968, I imagine that was even more the case.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I've talked to somebody who wrote a nonfiction book about spy gadgets, but he'd been the head of like their Q in the CIA, basically. And he said, you know, like even he, when they were trying to get it published, the CIA censors would push back against all of these stories. And he's like, all of these, like the things that we see here, they're all like there have been other books published about this stuff. I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't already know, but it doesn't matter to a certain point to them. So, which is
I mean, crazy. I've had, you know, there's often a lot of sensitivity, quite rightly so, but there's often a lot of sensitivity around technical things. So in one of my books, I wanted to make reference to the ability that if, for example, you know, let's say I've got my phone with me, if I were to go to another place, that some sort of alert would let the government know that I was going there because my phone was moving in that direction. Now this is something that everyone knows about and exists on our phones. You know, if you allowed me to, I could track you, and people have their home heating system set up so that if, you know, when your phone comes within a kilometer of your house, the boiler activates and the radiators start warming up. So this technology is well known and is publicly available, and there's nothing secret about it. But I wanted to make reference to something like this, and I was told that's a secret capability. Then there's a long conversation about how on earth can that be a secret capability when everyone knows it exists and everyone has it on their phone. But there's no real discussion possible about these points. You really have to just accept the verdict that is given.
Yeah. So let's dive into Turner a little bit more, because he's a guy who he's been divorced. It sounds as though he was cheated on by his wife. His wife left him. And he's also somebody who doesn't seem to be very opposed to violence. You know, there's a numerous times where he talks about wanting to hit somebody or hit a woman. It's all very dark. I mean, this guy is a very dark kind of a character. And I think you spoke about how Lacara hates the other character. He hates Turner the most, right? I mean, I think that's the problem with that is that by the time we get to the end, because the whole way through, as I said, Turner's been shown to be smart at the start. He figures out what's going on finally, but it's only after beating his head against the wall, thinking the worst of Harding throughout, right? You know, and saying the worst about him to all these people that he's talking about. And so it makes his kind of turnaround at the end, where he really does want to support Leo, very unconvincing, I think. Did you feel that as well or not?
I did. There were repeated references in the book to Leo and Alan Turner being two halves of the same whole, or one's the kind of the heart, the reverse of the other, but they were somehow connected. And there were a number of characters who Turner engaged with, who said to him, "You two are the same. You're very like each other." This the pairing was pushed on us. We were told constantly that they're connected, but it was something I never quite understood. I mean, they're both outsiders, fine, but beyond that, I couldn't really understand what this kind of mystical connection was between these two characters. You know, if that had been more compelling, then I think I would have accepted the ending when, you know, as you describe, Alan, you know, wants to save Leo and is immensely protective of him and sees him as kind of being heroic in this very corrupt world. But it is odd. It does slightly come out of nowhere. It doesn't quite make sense. I think the violence thing you mentioned is, you know, is really quite difficult. I mean, there's a scene at the end where he's talking to Hazel Bradfield, who's the wife of a senior diplomat in the embassy, and Leo Harting was having an affair with her, and he surprises Hazel at this meeting place where she used to meet Leo, and kind of takes her by surprise, and in his very brutal way interrogates her and gets the story out of her. But he hits her constantly throughout this interrogation. He said he hit her again with a long swinging blow deep into the flesh of her cheek. I mean, this is a woman who's heartbroken, who's lost her lover, who hasn't done anything wrong, and Alan Turner comes in swinging his fist. It's all quite unpleasant to read. There's also a kind of thread here that there's another character in the embassy whose name I can't remember, but he was posted to Warsaw before, and he had a daughter who was with him in Warsaw, who was kind of tricked by the Russians, I think, into having an affair with this young guy, and she got pregnant by him. Big crisis in the embassy, and Alan Turner was sent out. So this is a previous case he did, that he was sent out there to deal with this daughter of a diplomat who'd misbehaved and got herself pregnant. And we find out that Alan Turner was so rough with her that she tried to kill herself. So he's a violent and brutal character who really smashes things up in his effort to get to the truth. I mean, we're told about him very early on. There's a lovely sentence that his boss says about him. He says, "You'd pull down a whole forest, you would, to find an acorn." And that captures his character very well.
Yeah. Well, and that Meadows is the character that you mentioned with the daughter. And yeah, that there's this sense that, you know, Turner's like, oh yeah, sorry about your daughter. Yeah, that was a little rough, I guess, but so be it. You know, I mean, he's very unapologetic about the way he behaves, even though he, you know, finds out that the way that he goes about things, it accomplishes what was supposed to happen, but just kind of, as you said, kind of blows everything else up in its aftermath, and he doesn't really care about the follow-on of everything.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, there's a Graham Greene is a writer that Le Carré is often linked to, and Graham Greene also has these quite kind of closed worlds, which are very distinctive, which are often very bleak. But Graham Greene has a, you know, his characters are often searching for something, whether it's spiritual or religious, and I think that just gives a kind of slightly different sense to the book and to the characters, which is missing in this book and maybe even in the Looking Glass War as well. They just strike me as very, very bleak. I mean, there's a famous line from a Leonard Cohen song where he says that there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And you feel that, or I feel that in Graham Greene's books, that the characters are cracked, but light comes through those cracks. But in Le Carré's books, or in this book anyway, the characters are cracked, but no light comes through those cracks. It's by the end of it, I mean, I want to be rid of all of them.
All right. Well, I'm going to pause things right here. We're going to end this episode, and we're going to be back in 2 weeks to finish our discussion of A Small Town in Germany. In that episode, we'll be talking about Le Carré's depiction of women in the novel. We'll be also taking a crystal ball to who and how we would potentially make this into a television adaption, something that I do know is kind of out there as a potential, that I know they're looking at all of his novels. And Le Carré actually attempted it himself, so we'll have a little attempt at doing our own version of that. That's all in 2 weeks, so until then, if you enjoyed the show, please follow us on Twitter, at Le Carré Cast, or go to lecarrecast.com and you can comment there. And if you do enjoy the show, you would be doing a huge favor to help other people find the show if you go online to your favorite podcast app and leave us a review. All right, until next time, thanks so much for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.